Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they applied their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. It's episode one, and my guest is Dr. Jo Mitchell, Director of the Mind Room, a wellbeing, psychology, and performance clinic in the uber hipster inner city suburb of Collingwood in Melbourne, here in Australia. I'm really excited to have Jo on the show as she's a source of inspiration to me and has been for several years. She has really diverse interests in psychology, all with a strong focus on helping high-functioning people, people who are excelling in one or more areas of their life, to maintain their balance, stay happy and well, and sometimes bounce back from mental illness, burnout, or episodes of significant stress. Jo's background is in the sports industry. She's on the board of Action for Happiness Australia. She's currently the MindMax project leader for the AFL Players Association, and she's here to tell us about her projects, her work with the high performers, and she'll give us some tips at the end for success, happiness, and fulfilling your potential. Welcome, Jo.
Thank you so much, Ellen, and very privileged to be guest number one.
Guest number one, it's very exciting. Jo, you work with professionals and high performers and have done throughout your career, is that right?
Yes, that's right, although not always as a psychologist. So
sure.
The psychology part is maybe the last couple of decades, that journey.
That's still a fair period of time, period of expertise and knowledge. Jo, what kind of work do you do at present with say, high performers and professionals? Give us a little rundown, if you will.
Okay. As you said, we've got this practice in Collingwood called the Mind Room, and there our focus is on health, well-being and performance. My co-founder of the Mind Room is Michael Inglis. He's a sport and performance psychologist. That's his kind of specialisation. So we work with a range of people from a whole bunch of different sporting performance codes, but also people that are high performers in their workplace or in other contexts in life, or even just performance in the creative arts industry. And as you said, they'll turn up for a host of reasons, from perhaps mental illness or this kind of idea of life could be better, or I could be performing better, what's holding me back. So we have a range of people that in our team that can work with people at different stages of their development. But we also run workshops, and the workshops are aimed very much at the public, and they are about, I think, ideas around how your mind and your body and your emotions and your behaviour all work together, and what you can do to get the best out of yourself in whatever context you're in, but also trying to make them really accessible for people. We get trained really well in how to interpret the academic science, and sometimes we get a little bit lost in talking about that rather than turning it into really pragmatic ideas that people can use in everyday life. So that's what we focus on, and trying to have a bit of fun while we do it.
Very important. And I'm in regard to the workshops, I mean, from my understanding or from what you've just described there, it really is trying to take what we know as psychologists about what helps to keep people happy and well and perhaps have a sense of meaning and purpose in life and deal with the day-to-day challenges that we all have. And to really make that accessible and helpful and usable for people. Is that right?
Absolutely. And so last night we ran a workshop on work transitions, how you manage change either in your workplace or in yourself, like that you're looking to shift career in some way. And then this weekend we've got a self-compassion workshop, which is very much for the perfectionist high achievers who are highly self-critical and could do with other ways of approaching their work and their life. So topics like that, mindfulness, We've got one coming up, a Healthy Habits program, which is new, and we have a health psychologist who runs that. So, yeah, just practical ways that you can answer some of the questions that bug us all, like, why can't I stick to my gym routine? You know, I said I was going to give up coffee and I struggle with that. Like, how do I do these things? Or how do I put in place a mindfulness practice? Like, it's one thing to know it's good for you, but what do I actually do and how do I weave it into my life?
Yeah, and what is, I mean, the thing that struck me when you were talking there was about particularly perfectionism. I think that's probably a common problem for lots of people, particularly people who are high achievers or who are functioning perhaps really well in some area of their life, you know, perhaps really, you know, going great guns career-wise, but still struggle with other aspects of their life, whether it's a daily routine or even perhaps managing that gap between their expectations of who I am and what I should be able to do versus what I seem to be doing right now.
Look, I think one of the big challenges that we're facing culturally is this idea that we can do it all. And so I think the pressure that has gone on to perhaps women in particular, but, you know, across the board, that we need to not just stay at home, raise children, but we need to be out and working, and our kids need to have this amazing kind of experience. So we're running around all over the place delivering them to different events, and we need to maintain our social connections. And so if you have perfectionist tendencies and you're trying to like get this right in all areas of your life, I think we're being really set up for failure. So letting go of, I think, the culture of busy and that you can do it all, and being a little more selective about what really matters to you at this phase of life and what's going to get priority, I think can be really helpful for people.
Yeah. And are they, I mean, I know there's certainly the issues that I hear from a lot of people. This, I need to be the perfect person, the perfect mother, the perfect friend, the perfect daughter, the perfect sister, the perfect colleague. You know, I really need, and I need to, you know, make sure I sleep well and I'm mindful and I go to the gym and, you know, my house looks beautiful. So I know that that from my experience is a common problem. I'm assuming that's the kind of stuff you're hearing from people as well who come perhaps to your workshops.
Yeah. Absolutely. Trying to like achieve in all these aspects of life and just the reality that that's not possible. So trying to like help people work with that and also to take them off, I guess, the fear driven, ways of being. So, you know, often people are being driven by self-criticism and fear rather than, we try to work with sort of values and mindful presence as your motivator. But that kind of fear cycle and that's effective short term, but long term, it leads to all sorts of, complications and very often a big fall for people that are used to being really in control and really sort of, successful in their life. So it's kind of like the better you're doing, the harder you fall when it does happen.
When it all comes crashing down. Yeah. I find that interesting, that notion of being able to motivate ourselves for a certain period via fear or via, you know, what we'd call a psychologist, perhaps avoidance goals, you know, having to stop doing things or stop behaving in a certain way or fear of a negative consequence versus and what kind of negative impact that can have because it's just unsustainable. What would you say is kind of the biggest aha type, you know, when people light up, you know, their eyes light up and they go, oh, wow, I'd never thought of it like that. Is there something, one element of what you teach in those sorts of workshops, or if you're discussing perfectionism or these high expectations that you think just, you know, lights up the mind and the brain and helps people to start seeing things differently?
Look, I think the biggest thing is realizing that you're not alone. That's why I love the power of like working in those group contexts, because people hear other people's stories, which are so similar, and they go, oh, I thought I was the only one that was having these kinds of thoughts and worrying about these things, and you do too, and you do too. And I think that that's almost a permission to let it go just in that process. Yeah. Like even talking about it on, you know, podcasts and getting these messages out there of the common humanity in this. We are not alone. We just don't talk about it enough. Mm-hmm. or if we do talk about it, we're not quite courageous enough to step away from it because it's a societal model that seems to be kind of fairly mainstream. So being brave enough to do it differently, I think, is hard for people.
Okay, wonderful. So that kind of, that awareness, I suppose there's a bit of that, that common understanding or common commonality, whatever the term may be, is part of self-compassion, isn't it? Sort of realizing that I'm not the only one who struggles, that I struggle too. It's part of the human condition. And then being able to, courage, you know, to step away and realize that this is not helping me in the long term to keep trying to live up to these expectations, whether they're expectations that I sense I get from others in the community or family or friends, or whether it's just my own internal expectations of who I am and how I should behave.
Yeah. And that's when I love it. Like, that's when we're getting into doing some of the values work and helping people to really understand what they think is most important in their life. So what do they stand for? What really matters to them? Because then you can make better choices for yourself about what takes priority. That kind of work we love doing. And just, I think for me, the thing that lights me up the most is just seeing people when they understand how their mind is working and what some of the common principles are, but what's maybe unique for them, and that they can actually direct a lot of this and manage it differently rather than try to control or avoid, but to actually work out, right, how do I kind of harness this and get it to flow in the direction I want it to. That stuff is just wonderful.
Yeah. And do you think that's what some of the power, I suppose, of psychology is, having that deeper understanding of how pretty much all humans think or behave, or the way that our environment shapes our behavior, those sorts of components that psychologists know and understand, but perhaps we haven't communicated terribly well over the past.
I don't know what it was like for you, Ellen, when you did your psych training, but I sat there in my psych training going, damn it, only I knew this when I was, you know, in my teenage years or 20. Life would have been so much easier. It's kind of amazing. Like, we get around in these bodies and minds and yet don't know how to steer the car.
Yes.
Absolutely. I think we need to get better at it, at helping people understand it. We'll probably be doing ourselves out of a job, but that's okay.
That's not such a bad goal to have, is it? To actually, you know, work on the principle that if we can communicate this stuff and communicate it well enough to people, that they don't need us anymore.
Yeah, absolutely the principle that we work on. It's everybody sort of benefits from having somebody with a different perspective looking at what your experience is and just checking in, bouncing ideas off. And I love those sessions. A lot of the time the clients are doing all the hard work and I'm just sitting here, yep, you got it. What about it? Yeah, this way a little bit. Or, yeah, they're the fun sessions.
It's coaching and guidance, isn't it?
Yeah, because they've got it.
Yeah.
They're kind of, they're just learning to be confident around that and to also tailor it to different contexts in their life. So something different has come up, you know, maybe there's a divorce or a separation. It's like, well, you've got all the skills. It's just a different context now, and it's learning how to apply them in that new transition.
Yeah, I love that car analogy, that we've got the vehicle, but we don't necessarily know how to drive it. And then for, you know, moving into those different contexts, it's like learning to drive. You know, you've got the basics and then you've got to start to learn how to navigate yourself into perhaps new areas, you know, like moving to a new city, and you've got to start driving around into new places and applying those principles that you learn of the road rules and how to navigate and how to drive the car into new areas of life, I suppose.
Yeah, and sometimes to get rid of some of those really terrible driving habits that you might have fallen into.
The things that you've built up over a lifetime that aren't actually helping you to be safer or to drive more effectively. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fabulous. So, Jo, you work with high performers and have done for a long time. Is there anything that you would say, I suppose, that's different between someone who's a high performer in their particular arena and the rest of us?
Physically, maybe.
Physically, maybe, yeah, yeah. Can you give me an example?
Well, just because they clearly have different physical capacities for whatever their sport might be, which is not to say that there's a whole lot of people that don't do elite sport that haven't don't have that potential, but physically. Mentally, I think nothing that can't necessarily be cultivated except for, I guess, that motivation and drive to achieve in their particular domain. But I would also say that people have that in a whole bunch of areas in life, very, very driven and motivated. This just happens to be around clear sporting performance goals. I think the ones, though, that really excel often have an amazing growth mindset. So they are incredibly able to deal with the discomfort and pain of failure, to look at it as a learning opportunity and to see how they can grow and thrive from that. What can they learn from it? I think where people perhaps don't get to that next level is when they don't have that, they have more of a fixed mindset about what they're doing, where talent is a lot more, the emphasis on talent and their capacity is emphasised rather than the fact that this is a learning process and you got to constantly work and strive and adapt to get better at what you do. And I think it depends on whether you're in a team environment or an individual environment as well, what the traits might look like. But essentially, you know, we're all human. It's the same brain. Yes. But they've got a very, very focused goal that they're setting out to achieve, and that requires prioritising and dedication to whatever that sport might be.
Yeah, yeah. I love the notion of that growth mindset and the ability to learn and perhaps make, you know, be prepared to make mistakes and to try new things in order to keep learning and growing. I know I have a 9-year-old son who's a very keen sportsman in a whole raft of different areas. He plays basketball and swims and plays footy. And I think, you know, for me, watching him go through that experience and try to, as much as I can, I suppose as a parent and as a psychologist, guide him, because he can be very harsh on himself when he doesn't feel that he's performed up to his expectations of himself. And I suppose, yeah, that's something for me to really think about as a parent, is that, you know, this is reminding him that this is about learning, about growing, that we try things, that this is new, that practice is important. In order to, you know, develop that, not only for his sporting capabilities, but across all the areas of his life.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it always amazes me when I very first went through university and probably a little bit less the second time or third time through, but the first time no one would ask questions. Like, you'd be in a tutorial and everyone would just hang back. And then if anyone did say anything, it would be about what they knew. And you kind of go, yeah, but we're all at university, or we're all in education to learn. We're here because we don't know.
Yeah,
we should be encouraging curiosity. And instead it was showing what you knew rather than being, I guess, a little bit vulnerable and declaring what you didn't know. And I always used to love the other person in the class that would ask the stupid questions, because it's like, yes, now I don't ask that.
Because it was the same question that everyone else had. I see that in workplaces. I do a lot of work in workplaces with teams and groups, and I'll sit in meetings, and I often see, it was something that I noticed a long time ago, is a tendency in meetings for everybody to take turns in saying what they know about something or to give their opinion on something.
Yeah.
And that there's rarely questions asked. There's rarely, you really, an opportunity to explore things on the basis that we don't know the answers to this. Let's see if we can work together and uncover what the answers might be, or to come up with new ideas and to be prepared to fail. There's a big tendency to be kind of risk averse and to just, I suppose, perpetuate what we already know, which is kind of, I wouldn't have thought was the aim.
No. And it's so refreshing when you do go into those environments where there is an openness to failure and acceptance of, you know, we're going to mess up, but what can we learn from it? And it's okay to share that. Like we've done a couple of little things at the Mind Room to try and create that, because you take a bunch of psychologists that have been striving all of their academic life to get into the next stage of the program, like it's really quite competitive, to then go, well, now you need to let go of that. I think sometimes that's hard. So we've tried to create that in some of the physical environment that we have. So we're in this converted warehouse in Collingwood, and it has those big exposed brick walls. So we just get out the piece of chalk and we have the screw-up wall on one part of the wall, where you can literally take the piece of chalk and go sort of mark up, yep, how to screw up. You don't have to write on there what it is, but it then creates a conversation, and it then kind of like opens things up using physical, visual tools and a little bit of humour around it, and it kind of makes it a little more palatable. But the interesting thing has been that most of the women have got pretty good at like marking up their screw-ups, but we're having to actually like mark up some of the guys' screw-ups for them behalf.
Okay.
They're not as active at it.
Okay, that's interesting, isn't it? Interesting gender difference there maybe between our willingness to publicly acknowledge our failures. Jo, I'd like to ask you about Action for Happiness. You are the deputy chair for Action for Happiness here in Australia, is that right?
Yes, it is, which is a real joy to bring Action for Happiness out to Australia. So they started in the UK. They've been running there for probably 7 years now. And so we're only a couple of years old. We're a registered charity, though, which is really fabulous and an amazing job done by the board. Still very small, run courses for community on, I guess, exploring what matters in life and looking at some of the topics that come out of the positive psychology and wellbeing literature, but also mindfulness and perhaps some of the more philosophical questions. And we've got an evening of happiness on the International Day of Happiness on the 20th of March in Melbourne. I think it's 6:30 it kicks off, but details are online if you put in Action for Happiness, Evening of Happiness. You'll find the details.
Yeah. And what's the goal of Action for Happiness? For some of our listeners may not know the organisation or the movement, I suppose it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a movement. The goal is to create a kinder, more compassionate and connected society. So that's the big goal.
A big goal.
Which is, fairly ambitious. But it's also what's key to it is it's about taking the best of the wellbeing literature and science and finding really practical action-based ways that people can integrate that into their life. So a bit like you might have like the five food groups, you have like minimum kind of expectations around physical activity in life. Well, what is it that we can do to look after our own happiness?
Okay. Okay, so it really is sort of translating, I suppose, concepts that people might already have an understanding of in terms of physical health and well-being into how do we create the same sort of idea and understanding in terms of mental health and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a book that's come out of movement. It's called The 10 Keys to Happier Living. I think some people will be familiar with the first five of those keys. And it's simple things like moving, making sure you get enough movement every day, connecting socially, so making sure that you look after your social interactions, learning, continuing to learn, and probably one of the most important ones, I think, is to give back, so to contribute back to the world, because the giving part is not only good for us, but it's good for the recipient of the giving as well. So really simple ideas. Often these are the things that when we're stressed or busy, they go by the wayside. We stop doing them when, in fact, we really need to do them.
Yeah, so that was the 10 keys to happiness.
Yeah.
I'll put those in the show notes, the details there, so that people can look them up if they're interested. And Jo, I'm interested to know, what do you do to maintain your own well-being? In each of my podcast episodes, I'm going to talk to experts about, you know, what they know and what they advise to other people, but also keen to know, you know, how do you actually implement this stuff in your own life?
Yeah, so I probably pretty significantly cut back on work a few years back. So gave up some pretty major job roles just to really focus on one thing and to try and get a better quality of life, because I found that I was just working every hour under the sun. I know that I can sustain this kind of pace that I have. I'm going to be working for a long time, so I want to really make the most of that. But also just really simple things. I'm not great at going to the gym these days, so I build in as much incidental movement into my daily life.
Yes.
Walking to work, or, you know, choosing to walk or to ride my bike rather than to jump in the car. But also the biggest thing for me is the social connectivity. And so I really try to look after my relationships with the people that matter. One of my favourite life roles is being an auntie. And so I'm lucky enough to have 9 nephews and nieces ranging from kind of 7 to 24. So staying really connected in their lives and, you know, making sure that they know that they're loved and appreciated, that's really important to me. But also the community that we've created in and around the Mind Room as well. That's just it's a beautiful place to be, and it's so open and friendly and embracing of the community that we sit in. And I think that that goes a long way to, I guess, destigmatizing kind of mental health. So I guess I've got goals in my life, and I look after my social connections and try and have fun.
That's the other thing. That positive emotion.
Yeah. It's even like, I think it's hard to do good therapy work with people if you're not also having a laugh through the process as well.
Yeah, the importance of humour, that, you know, I think it's really underrated probably in our sense of, you know, the key things for our well-being, that being able to have a laugh, have a sense of humour about things, even in topics, you know, perhaps like you do cover in therapy that seem inherently stressful or difficult, but there is a little bit of humour in everything that can really kind of lighten the load and perhaps change our perspective, you know, a tiny bit.
Absolutely. I think it definitely helps.
I think we've covered lots of really interesting stuff, lots of great tips there and ideas for our audience, hopefully, in terms of maintaining their own well-being, thinking about the importance of even those simple things like moderate exercise, incidental movement, that social connectedness and staying in touch with the people that are important, and the piece right at the beginning where we talked about stripping things back to understanding our values and who we are as individuals, and to use that to really help guide our decisions and our actions, but also perhaps lessen some of those high expectations that we might have that cause us stress and de-stress at times. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ellen.
I'll put the details in the show notes for people to find the Mind Room, to find your workshops, to find what's going on with Action for Happiness, and some of the tips that you've suggested today. Thank you for sharing my conversation with Dr. Jo Mitchell. I hope you enjoyed Jo's enthusiasm and positive take on life and its challenges, as well as her tips for happiness and health as much as I did. You can download a copy of Jo's wellbeing tips to remind you of the simple action that you can take to stay resilient and happy on the Potential Psychology website. Go to potential.com.au/podcast. There you'll also find links to the Mind Room, Action for Happiness, and the books that Jo recommended. If you're keen to get hold of all of the free tips and resources that our guests offer podcast listeners, you can by signing up to my regular newsletter at potential.com.au/subscribe or follow the link on the homepage. And if you want every episode of the Potential Psychology podcast to appear like magic in your favourite podcast player, then please do subscribe. In episode 2 of the podcast, I talk to Martine Oglethorpe, parenting and e-safety expert, about her positive take on kids and the cyber world and her tips for parents keen to navigate the digital divide. Join me next time and have a fabulous week.